Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on whose land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. Also, a big shout out to everybody around the country that is tuning in via the National Indigenous Radio Service, getting beamed across the country and the world, bringing 98.9 FM into your homes. Hope everybody has been good. Over the weekend, I was down in Melbourne, caught up with some deadly mob down there, which is really, really good. So I have some stuff planned, for the rest of the week or next week. I think next week would be good. This week is already planned out. But on the program this morning, we have a special guest joining us all the way from Newcastle. My guest is Professor Lyndall Ryan. And we're going to be yarning a bit about some of the massacres that have taken place and that have shaped this continent today. I won't get into too much detail about what we're going to talk about. I'll let my guest explain that a bit. Professor Lyndall, just before we start, could you tell us your name and a bit about yourself, please?
Yes, good morning, Bo. My name is Lyndall Ryan. I'm a professor of history at the University of Newcastle, which is about 160 kilometres north of Sydney. And for many years, I've been focusing on frontier violence in Australia. And with changes in new technology, the opportunity came a few years ago to develop an online digital map which would record as many sites of massacre that I could find. And I've been working on this project now with a very small team for the last 4 or 5 years. And a couple of weeks ago, we put up stage two of the map, which includes about 240 sites of massacres of Aboriginal people and about 10 sites of massacres of non-Aboriginal people. We're only halfway there. We've yet to include any sites from Western Australia, and we have much more work to do on Central Australia and in Eastern Australia as well.
Oh, definitely much work and big work as well to correlate all this, the numbers, the sites. That must be a really, really big thing. So stage two, was that the launch of the site to sort of get more input from community people?
I think so, particularly as we're moving into the 20th century and particularly as we're moving into the Northern Territory, far north Queensland and into South Australia. Communities there have contacted me. We do have a contact page on the map and nearly 500 people have taken advantage of that and contacted us with more information about particular sites or given us new information about sites that we're yet to put up on the map. It's a very time-consuming project because everything has to be double-checked before it goes up. But there's no doubt that we've had very positive responses from many Aboriginal communities, and that's been very heartening for the people on the project. We know now that we're moving in the right direction. Some people have contacted us with their understanding and their memories of massacre. I sometimes can't put it on the map because we don't have enough specific detail. And that's what I'm always searching for, a date or an idea of a place. And I'll talk more about how we put the site up on the map in a moment. But we need to get a sense of when it could have happened, particularly a year when it could have happened, or even within a date of, say, 5 to 10 years. We can work on that, and that often gives me some clues to look up in other source materials.
So before we get Yeah, onto, I guess, uploading and some of the stuff that's on the website. Yep. What was stage one?
Stage one came out about a year ago, and that included about 172 sites in eastern Australia, up to 1872. So it included sites in Tasmania, Victoria, parts of New South Wales, and parts of Queensland. And that sort of got the ball rolling. That was to sort of give people an indication, this is what we're doing, this is how we're doing it, we'd love to hear from you.
And in the media release that you've put out, the title is Massacres of Australia's Colonial Frontier Climbs to 250. What was the numbers, I guess, prior to releasing like this media release and also going back into doing the research?
I'm sorry. Can you say that again? I'm a bit...
Sorry about that. Like the media release that that the university put out, it's titled Massacres of Australia's Colonial Frontier Climbs to 250. What were the numbers prior to that?
Well, before that, we had about 172 sites. Mm-hmm. So the stage two has 80 more sites than stage one. So it's gradually climbing, and each of those new sites that have gone on the map, it usually needs at least, you know, 3 or 4 days hard research, and some of them take weeks to work out where they are. It's very time consuming. We do try and give coordinates about where the sites are. We do try and give at least 2 or 3 sources to support what happened. And we try and get as much detail about the Aboriginal group, the name of the group. We try and include the names of the perpetrators of the massacre. And we try and work out what were the specific causes of that massacre taking place. So it's very detailed work to do, but we believe it's very important, and we believe it's a project that has the potential to change the way in which we look at the past.
Definitely, of course it would, and then also, I guess, how we could sort of reflect on the future as well and help, I guess, you know, sort of bridge the many big gaps that also close and, you know, get away from those stereotypical views of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and also see how, you know, if I remember a few years ago, I think it was Tony Abbott was saying this continent was settled, you know, wasn't invaded, you know, tried to sort of sweep the rug of, you know, the true history of this country. It speaks to that as well?
Yes, it does. It indicates that certainly Australia was invaded, and that Aboriginal people certainly defended their country and are still defending their country. You know, we're stage two of the map goes up till 1930, and stage three will go up to 1960. So we've got a long way to go, but many of the massacres that we're looking at are within memory of many Australians today.
Definitely.
And many people have come forward with stories of their memories. Both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people have done that, and I think it's an opportunity for people to tell their stories and their memories, and I think people are looking for a way of reconciling the past, and I'm hoping that this map will help that process.
Definitely. And like one thing that I always say to people as well when like yarning about the frontier wars is that, you know, there were so many generations of people that, you know, fought in these frontier wars battles, and then, you know, the moment that this country was involved in wars and conflicts outside of Australia, Aboriginal people signed up straight away. You know, and this could be, you know, their parents who fought against, you know, colonial invaders, you know, to their territory, and then, you know, a generation or two later, you know, we see Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people, you know, getting involved in conflicts outside of Australia as well.
Yes, that's very true. Aboriginal people have a very proud record of service in Australia's armed forces overseas. And my colleague, John Maynard, has been conducting, a major project on trying to identify all of those Aboriginal servicemen in in the Boer War, in World War One, World War Two, the Korean War, and the Korean War as well. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt they've been very proud service people, and they've done a wonderful job for Australia.
Definitely. One thing, like, I want to add about Stage 2, you've added 81 additional sites to the map.
Yep.
And I'm just going to read out the numbers and also whereabouts. So Northern Territory, 19, South Australia, 13, Queensland, 28, New South Wales, 17, Victoria, 1, and Tasmania, 3. And you did mention before as well, you know, there were so many more other, inputs of different massacre sites that you got, but you couldn't add them because of they didn't have sufficient evidence regarding date, place, how long it took. But with these here, with these 81 here, how do you process, you know, all of these stories? Because it must be a difficult process to come to terms with. Yeah.
Yes, Bo, it's incredibly difficult. And there are some days where we just have to walk away from it. Some of the stories are just so heartbreaking, and it also very confronting. Many of the stories are very, very confronting. And, you know, you have to draw breath, and sometimes you just have to walk away. And I have to confess, there have been sometimes, you know, weeks where I just simply can't look at it. It's too hard and I have to go and work on other things. But on the other hand, when people contact us with information, we realise that people, first of all, are looking at the map and that they want to contribute. And we feel we have a great responsibility to respond to that. People have been very generous with their time. They've been very generous in sending us information that I would never have been able to access. They're often letters or even diaries. Some people have sent us some tapes of interviews that they've carried out, sometimes with non-Aboriginal people, sometimes with Aboriginal communities. Also, there are important collections of oral histories of Aboriginal people that have been taking place ever since the tape recorder was invented and started to be used more widely, and that was in the 1950s. So since then, there's been an ever-increasing collection of stories and accounts from Aboriginal people that have been put on tape. Some of them are in the Institute of Aboriginal Studies in Canberra. Some of them are in museums. Some of them are in private collections. I haven't been able to access all of them by any means. And I do try to focus on published accounts so that they can be checked, you know. And in many cases, Aboriginal people have given their stories to historians and anthropologists and archaeologists, and they have been quoted in articles and books that they've written up. So there's actually a lot more information around than I first realised. But accessing all of that, of course, takes time, and sometimes people point us in directions or they tell us about books that I haven't heard of so I can rush off and access them. In a strange way, Bo, a lot of information is there, but it's never really been looked at seriously. And I'm trying to say the stories are there. I don't have to go out and interview people myself. The stories are all there, and it's my job to bring them in. It's like they're all out there in this big ocean of information, and I've got to reel it in.
Definitely.
It's been very important.
And definitely, you know, this is something that Aboriginal people have been talking about, you know, since invasion, is, you know, the stuff that our people faced in our communities all over the country. It was always something that was spoken about, but like you were saying, nobody listened or nobody believed that it took place. When I look at, you know, the site map, and then the numbers that you've done, like the 81, Queensland speaks out a lot. You know, like why, I guess, Yeah. Why is there so many numbers? Obviously, because it was recorded more, or there was just more discussion than.
Yes, yeah. That's a very good question, Bo. There's no doubt that Queensland is a place where a lot of massacres took place, and they began in the early 1840s, or probably even in the 1830s, almost as soon as white people arrive in Queensland, in the first settlement around Moreton Bay, present-day Brisbane. But in the early 1830s, we've got the first massacres on Stradbroke Island. And then that sweeps up around the Brisbane River, out past Ipswich and up to the Darling Downs. And we've got quite a lot there. These settlers are very confident people, and many of them have come up from New South Wales or Victoria, and some of them have even come up from Tasmania. So they've already had violent encounters with Aboriginal people. So they've come with a bit of a mindset that nothing is going to stop them from bringing in lots of sheep and cattle. They want to make a lot of money very quickly. They're often overstocking, and they're often encountering drought. And so there's an immediate contest for the water holes, so the creeks and the rivers. You know, Aboriginal people have, they need their livestock in a way, which are the kangaroo and emu and all of those animals that they hunt. They need to drink water, and the sheep and cattle want water. So there's a contest for water resources right from the outset. And it's usually that contest that leads to major conflict and leads to the massacres taking place. It becomes quite relentless in Queensland. And as we know, Queensland has quite an extreme in its climate. It's either drought or it's either flooding rains. And I think that the settlers pretended that neither extreme mattered, that they wanted to bring in their sheep and cattle, and they would do it regardless of what the season was or what was going on. I think the other thing about Queensland is that it certainly supported a very large Aboriginal population. We're still uncertain of what that population was before white people came, but from what we can gather, it was a very large population, very substantial, and Aboriginal people knew how to manage the environment incredibly well. So I think they were in a stronger position to resist the settlers when they came in with their sheep and cattle. So you've got a much better prepared Aboriginal population in Queensland than perhaps, say, in Tasmania. And so I think that Aboriginal people, and also I think stories have obviously had reached Queensland of the violence that was happening further south, and so they might have been a little bit better prepared as well. So that, you know, there's a lot of interesting factors, and I'm hoping that by trying to identify the massacre sites, that we'll get a better picture of what was happening and how it was happening. We also have to remember that it's in Queensland that we have the most massacres of non-Aboriginal people. In other words, Aboriginal people were really prepared to fight for their country. And we've got the big massacres of white people at Hornet Bank, at Cullen-Laringo. We've got another one just outside of Rockhampton. And then we've got those that happen along the coastline with shipwrecks, where Aboriginal people are very anxious to defend their country from white people. So Queensland is a big story. It's a big story.
If you're just tuning into the program, my guest this morning is Professor Lyndall Ryan from the University of Newcastle, a researcher, academic, and she is a part of the University Center for the 21st Century's Humanities and the Center for History of Violence. We're just going to head to a quick song break and we'll be back after the program. One of the things I want to talk about as well is when it's, you know, when we talk about the conflict that happened in this country, massacres, you know, it's either massacres or it's conflicts. And when we talk about conflicts, it's like it's an agreed war between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. I'd like to talk a bit about how that sort of took place, the weapons and how these things went on. My guest is Professor Lyndall Ryan, and you are listening to Let's Talk. This song is Kev Carmody with They Shall Not Steal. You're listening to 98.9 FM.
Down Sydney Cove, the first boat people land, and they say, sorry boys, our gain's your loss, we're gonna steal your land. And if you break our new British law, for sure you're gonna hang, or work your life like our convicts, with the chain on your neck and hands. And they taught us, whoa, black woman, thou shalt not steal. Said, hey, yeah, black man, thou shalt not steal. We're gonna civilize black barbaric life, teach you how to kneel, that your history couldn't hide genocide, the hypocrisy that was as real. Why your Jesus said you're supposed to give the oppressed a better deal. We say to you, yes, our land, thou shalt not steal. Well, your science and technology, hey, you can make a nuclear bomb. Development has increased its size, 3 million megatons. And if you think that's progress, I suggest your reasoning is unsound. For you should have found out long ago, you best keep it in the ground. And they taught us, oh, black woman, thou shalt not steal. We're gonna civilize your black barbaric lives, and we teach you how to kneel. But your history couldn't hide the genocide, hypocrisy that whispers real. Why your Jesus said you're supposed to give the oppressed a better deal. We say to you, yes, white man, thou shalt not steal. Whoa, yeah. That blazing sun go down behind a tall tree and mountain ridge. The land's our heritage and spirit here. The rightful culture's black. And we're sitting here just wondering when we're gonna get that land back. They taught us, whoa, black woman, thou shalt not steal. They said, yeah, black man, thou shalt not steal. We're gonna civilize you, black barbarian. Lives, and we teach you how to kneel. But your history couldn't hide the genocide, the hypocrisy that was real. Why, your Jesus said you're supposed to give the oppressed a better deal. We say to you, this white man, thou shalt not steal. Whoa, here I land, you better heed. Well, you talk of conservation, pristine green, but in 200 years your materialism has stripped the forest clean. And a racist's a contradiction that's understood by none. Mostly their left hand holds a Bible, right hand holds a gun. And they taught us, whoa, black woman, thou shalt not steal. Say, hey, black man, thou shalt not steal. We're gonna civilize your black barbaric lies, and we teach you how to kneel. But your history couldn't hide the genocide, the hypocrisy that was real. Or your Jesus said you're supposed to give the oppressed a better deal. We say to you, yes, white man, thou shall not steal.
This is Bo Spearum with Let's Talk.
And you're back on Let's Talk. My guest on the program this morning is Professor Lyndall Ryan from the University of Newcastle. She's a researcher and academic and a historian. I'm sure she's a historian if she's going through all this information. Yeah, Lyndall, we were yarning off air about something. Well, I wanted to ask you how, you know, like, I guess these massacres took place, and also the numbers. You know, like, obviously these weren't, you know, like, when we talk about, I guess, the beginning of Australia, you know, invasion, you know, it's always, they always use the term conflict, like it was an agreed sort of war between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. But, you know, going through your research, you know, and listening to the conversations we've been having today and over, you know, over time, it was straight up massacres, the way that they, you know, went about their business to sort of make Australia what it is today. I'd like, yeah, let's have a bit of a yarn about some of the things that they did use and how it took place.
Yes, certainly. My research reveals that massacres usually happened for three reasons. They were always usually in response to something that the settlers believed Aboriginal people did. Many of them would happen because Aboriginal people would have killed, say, a stockman or a settler. But the Aboriginal people had usually killed that person because that stockman had stolen an Aboriginal woman or had been made an agreement with an Aboriginal group to access certain resources, and the protocols had broken down, or he'd overstepped the mark, and so he had to pay the price. But the local settlers wouldn't see it like that, and they would see that as a reason to get retribution. Another reason was that Aboriginal people often took cattle in particular, because the kangaroos had been removed, so they were replacing it as a food supply. The settlers didn't see it like that. So that would be a second reason for carrying out a massacre. And a third reason was because the settlers believed that they had the view, we've got to clear Aboriginal people out of the way. We want this place really cleared out, so they would just go in and do it anyway. And that's what I call an opportunity massacre. The number of people killed in one operation to constitute a massacre on the map is the killing of the minimum of six people. And we've chosen six because Aboriginal people have told us that most of their campsites contained up to about 20 people in an extended family. And you kill six people in one go, undefended people, in one operation, that's 30% of that group. So that group has immediately had a major inroad into their ability to keep on as they were, that their ability to hunt, to perform ceremonial, to reproduce, all of those things. And that makes them immediately vulnerable to further attack and vulnerable to introduce disease. So that's how we're operating in that. That's how the map operates in that way. What we found also is that most of the massacres usually take place early in the morning. It's an attack on a campsite and the people are undefended. Or that they've found, or that the attackers realise that the Aboriginal people might be engaged in ceremonial or or are in a particular area where they can be very quickly corralled and they can't escape. This means that massacres are very much a planned event. Mm. I always thought that a massacre was something that was a rush of blood to the head and it was a very spontaneous act. But no, it's very carefully planned. The attackers know exactly what they're doing. They want to get the advantage. Mm. In Queensland, most of the massacres take place, most of the perpetrators are on horseback. Horses become very much more widely available in Australia from the early 1830s, which is just at the point where Queensland is invaded by the settlers. So the horse is a critical weapon for the attackers. If they're not on horseback, they're kind of on the same level, at the same height as the Aboriginal people. So that's really important. And once horses become available, the attackers are looking for a weapon that they can use from horseback. And the carbine is the weapon that is invented for people to be able to shoot effectively on horseback.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, the Brown Bess musket was really designed for the foot soldier.
Yeah.
So once we've got people on horseback, they're wanting weapons that they can use very effectively on horseback. So they start with the carbine, and then around about mid-1850s, 1860s, we're getting repeating rifles, the Snider, the Martini Henry, and the Winchester. And they're more powerful. They can shoot for a longer range. They can do more devastating damage. So as time goes on, the weapons become more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
The attackers can do more damage, kill more people in one go.
And
it's very tough.
And they used, they poisoned people as well?
Yes, poison is certainly around. There's not a lot of examples of it. I'm just trying to think how many I've got for Queensland off the top of my head. I've probably got about half a dozen cases. Mm-hmm. Now, poisoning, that has to be very carefully planned because it could end up with the people doing the poisoning getting poisoned themselves. It's usually poisoning food, the damper, where the attackers that might be a station cook is told to put arsenic or strychnine into flour that's making damper, and then you offer the damper to the Aboriginal people. We've got a big case at Kilcoy in the early 1840s where up to 60 Aboriginal people were killed in that way. And that's definitely a massacre because it's a carefully planned event to get rid of Aboriginal people. And it's very gruesome to read, let me tell you. Very gruesome.
Oh, of course it would be, yes.
Dreadful. And we've got a couple of other cases. Interestingly, the colonial authorities did not approve of poisoning. And there we do have a couple of cases where attempts are made to arrest the perpetrator and to bring them to justice. They never quite make it, but there's some interesting records about those cases.
Another thing we were yarning off air, which was, and in the report, just before you mentioned stage two of your research extends up to the 1930s and stage three goes up to the 1960s. I asked you off air, what did you mean by that regarding massacres? So for our listeners, what did you mean by extending the research up to the 1960s? And taking mind, that's a lot of, for me, that's my parents' generation as well.
That's right. It's all terribly recent. What we've done, we've decided to stop in 1960 because we know they happen after that, but we've got better records up to 1960. We know that they were happening in the top end up to the 1960s and quite likely beyond. So for both the survivors and the perpetrators, massacre is a very recent activity.
Mm.
It's been going on since the beginning of the invasion, and it wouldn't surprise me if it is still going on. It's a characteristic of the frontier in Australia, and it never seems to stop. It only stops when settlement moves on or Aboriginal people are entirely removed from an area, or that they've or that they're no longer resisting in the way that the settlers don't like. So it's something we need to, you know, the idea of a massacre we need to understand. But it's also massacre happens because Aboriginal people are resisting the invaders in the way that they know best. They're trying to contain the invaders. They're trying to drive them away. They're trying to incorporate the invaders into their own social system and make them operate according to Aboriginal cultural values. And it's a very, I think that one of the reasons why it has been so hidden is because many terrible things happened, and my map is only going to be able to reveal a small part of the story.
Yeah.
But what the map can do is show how dreadful and violent that story was.
Oh, definitely. And I guess in all of your research, what are the accumulating numbers of Aboriginal people that have, died from the result of these massacres?
We're trying to get some numbers. Well, yes, it's, I have to remember that massacre isn't the only thing that happens on the frontier. Many people get killed in ones and twos and so on. They're harder to document and harder to identify. But a massacre is a pretty awful thing. And so from the statistics we're getting so far, we've got about 6,000 people who've been, Aboriginal people, who've been killed overall.
Mm-hmm.
But these are minimum numbers.
Yeah.
Because with a massacre, it has to be at least six to get on the map. But often we don't, they might say, oh, many Aboriginal people were killed.
Mm.
Well, how many is many?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and many people have asked that, and we're going to have to make some estimates about that. You know, is 8 many or is 20 many? We don't know. Sometimes we do get more precise numbers where we'll say 30 people were killed. What I can say from my work so far, that we know that in Tasmania, the average number of people that were killed in massacres was 11. When we get to Victoria, the average number is 26.
Mm.
When we get into Queensland with the numbers that I've done, with the massacres I've done so far, we've got an estimate of 40. So that's a better way of seeing how devastating a massacre is to Aboriginal communities. And as time moves on, the numbers that are killed in a massacre increase for two reasons. One, there are more Aboriginal people around. And secondly, because the weapons that are available to the perpetrators are more sophisticated.
Mm.
They can do more damage. So in that way, the impact on Aboriginal communities just becomes greater over time.
Mm, definitely. Two questions. Do you ever think that your research would sort of tell the story of how, I guess, be recognised in mainstream Australia, that Aboriginal people, the defending of this country, is on par with, any other war that, is recognised around the world. Do you think that there'll ever be, the sufficient recognition of the, the wars that Aboriginal people fought here?
Absolutely. There's no doubt. The fact that these wars continued for so long, they began within a few years of the first invasion in 1788, and in my view, they're probably still going on today in parts of Australia. So it's a war over a very long period of time. We also know that a lot of white people were killed in this war, and the map will be is recording that as
well. How many?
We haven't got particular numbers at the moment, but we think that it'll probably be about... Well, I can't really give you any estimates at the moment, but I do know, for example, in Tasmania, it's about for every... I think the ratio is about four Aboriginal people killed for every white person killed.
Yeah, yeah.
In Victoria, it's one white person for every 26 Aboriginal people. But I, you know, these estimates change as I get more information. Yeah. So it's a pretty fluid situation. But I'm hoping by the end of stage three, those estimates will be much clearer. But what we know is that the whole of the frontier wars were based on fear. Fear of each side. And war, it's a great driver of violence, is fear. And so these wars are very comparable to what is going on the Western Plains of the United States from the mid-1840s. They're very comparable to the wars that are going on in New Zealand in the 1840s and the 1860s. Very comparable to the wars that went on in South Africa in the same period. So really these frontier wars, these colonial wars, are going on right across the British Empire, and the Australian story needs to be told, to be put in that war, and be more widely recognised that wherever there's an invasion of Indigenous lands, people are going to resist and defend their lands, and that story hasn't been fully told yet in Australia.
Definitely, yeah, that's something that we see, like you said, all over the world. It's never recognised. Do you see instances, I guess, here or around the world where there's more recognition of, I guess, massacres or things like this that have taken place?
Well, it's very interesting when it comes to massacre. I was talking to a colleague in New Zealand, and they said it's interesting, there were quite a lot of massacres, but they haven't really been acknowledged in the way that they should be. We know that they went on in South Africa. I think there's a whole new generation of researchers that are really bringing these massacres out now. There have been stories of battles. My investigation of a lot of the so-called battles in Australia, I find that all the casualties are all on one side. Well, normally with a battle, you get casualties on both sides, but we're finding in Australia that these so-called battles are more where Aboriginal people are more likely to be suffering the casualties rather than the white people, and I get very suspicious of that. I think that some of these battles are really a mask for dreadful massacres that took place. But we're beginning to understand how these frontier wars are being fought. We do know that in the early days, the first 20 years of settlement in Australia, that most of the massacres were carried out by British soldiers with attached to the British regiments, and then as settlement moves out further and further, then it's going to be mounted police. And then in Queensland, of course, the native police are formed specifically with the of clearing the frontier. And the native police operate exactly like the sepoys do in India, where they're hired from different parts of the country to go in and act as crack troops, special forces groups, really, where they're not expected to reveal what they're doing or how they're doing it. And the native police were set up to absolve the settlers of having to remove Aboriginal people from their country. And that's one of the other sides of being part of the British Empire, because that's how the British Empire operated. They were always looking for other people to do their dirty work for them.
Definitely, definitely. And like you said, all over the place, all over the world.
Yes, it happens all over the world.
If you're just tuning in to Let's Talk, my guest on the program this morning is Professor Lyndal Ryan, sorry. And we've been yarning about the research that she's undertaken for quite some time now. How can people see the website and some of the research that you've been putting together? What's that website called?
Yes, the website is called, I think it's called the Colonial Massacres Map. So if you just type in on the internet, Colonial Massacres Map, and that will bring you up to the official website, and from there you can click onto the map. So most it's becoming more user-friendly. The stage two is technically easier to operate than stage one, and people have been telling us that it's been quite easy to access. And the map and the web page itself has on the right-hand side, it's got a menu, and if you click onto that, you can get various stages. You can get the map itself, and you can click onto any of the dots and get information. There's also a timeline which lists all of the massacres in chronological order and information about them. And then we've also got a contact page, and we'd love to hear from you. So the contact page is a way of letting us know if you've got more information or that you about an existing site that you know about and that you'd like us more information, or you want to query where the site might be and all of that, or that you have information about a site that's not on the map. We'd love to hear from you about that as well. Maybe I could just say a little bit more about how we've recorded the site on the map. In talking with many Aboriginal communities before the map went up, many of them made clear to us that they were very nervous about the actual site being put on the map. They were concerned that there are remains of people there that they wanted to respect and certainly did not want to disturb. And they were also concerned that some of these sites could be desecrated. And we do know with some sites that has occurred. So what we've done is we've given a general point. So rather than saying the massacre happened on a particular creek bed, at that part of a creek bed, we'll give it in a general region of that creek bed. So it's not going to give you the actual spot, but it will give you the area within about 250 metres. So I'd like to reassure your listeners that we're not here to, make life more difficult, but to indicate that in that general area, a terrible thing happened. I've lost you.
Oh, sorry. I was pressing the guest mic. Yep. Sorry about that. I had the guest mic on. My bad. Because I switched the mics off when you were talking. So.
That's all right.
I guess just in this back end of the program, how did you get involved? How and why did you get involved in, researching the massacres that took place in this country? Because it's a very, very important issue to sort of start to discuss about and to sort of get out to the public as well.
Yes. Well, I've been involved for a very long time now because about 15 years ago, Australia was embroiled in what was called the Aboriginal History Wars, which was a very nasty debate about whether there were massacres on the frontier in Australia. And I had done a lot of work in Tasmania, and although I wasn't calling a lot of the violence massacres, there were a couple of journalists who believed that I had invented incidents of massacre in the Black War in Tasmania, and I had done a lot of work on Tasmania, written a couple of books on the Black War in Tasmania. So I thought, what is this event called a massacre? And so I started doing a lot more research into how do you define a massacre, what are its characteristics. And then I realized that with changes in technology, that it would be possible to create a map and identify a lot of the sites. And I got a lot of technical help, and of course I've got fantastic technical support staff to help me there. And once the idea took off, everybody thought it was a good idea. So I was able to finally get some research funding to get the project underway. And I have to say, it's been an incredibly important project to do. It's made me rethink the whole of Australian history, and particularly the whole frontier in Australia, and to realise that it was much more violent than ever I realised, and I've found many more sites than I thought I would find at the beginning of the project.
Definitely. And you know, it's funny, you know, that you said in the early days when you were, you know, writing articles, people were saying you were making claims about, you know, these things that never happened, making up massacres. How common back then was it to sort of dismiss, you know, something like this, you know, when talking about massacres? And how much has it changed over the last, I guess, like you said, 15 years? Now people are sort of starting to recognize and realize these things actually did take place.
Well, when I was first training up as a historian many decades ago, I had a number of Aboriginal students, and they would take me out to meet their families. Whether at that stage I was living in Brisbane, working at Griffith University, and a couple of my Aboriginal students took me up to places around the back of Bundaberg where their families were living, and one of them said, "Oh, that's the site where there was a massacre of my ancestors." And I just couldn't believe him. I just couldn't hear what he was saying. I thought, well, you know, there were some massacres, we all knew that, but there weren't very many. And maybe there was a story about massacre that went through many Aboriginal communities, but there was really only one or two. So I've had to learn to hear, to listen, to understand, to take it seriously and to work through. I didn't believe white people could do this. You know, I'm a white person, I'm a white fella. Mm. I couldn't believe it. So if you can't believe it, you don't hear. You don't hear.
Yep.
So over time, I've had to listen, I've had to check out things, and, you know, in most cases, the stories were true. And that's what I'm having to put on the map now, that there's a lot of evidence. And I think now a lot of white Australians are beginning to listen, are hearing a lot better, our hearing has improved, and that we're understanding it. And I've been very heartened by the very strong support I've received for the map. People writing to me, white fellas writing in and saying, we need to know this story. Why haven't we heard it before? It's long overdue. This is very important work. So it's very heartening. I think there has been a shift in consciousness on the part of white Australians, and that they do want to know now. I think as a historian and looking at other parts of the world, it seems to me you need about 200 years before people can stand back and look at the terrible things that happened.
Yes, definitely. Professor, we're just going to have to wrap the program up. As much as I'd love to keep yarning,
that's fine.
I just want to say a big thank you for joining us on the program this morning. For our listeners, if you liked this program, jump onto our website at 989fm.com.au for the podcast, or tune in at 7 p.m. tonight on 989fm. Big thank you to Professor Lyndall Ryan for coming on the program this morning.
Thank you for having me.
I am Manoia, come limerail my ear. I am Manoia, come limerail. Yeah, come a limerite, oh my, oh my, yeah, come a limerite, oh my, yeah, come a limerite, my roar, oh my, oh.
travel far from my home because you said that I should go to learn a new way of life. But my spirit remains in bondage to love.